Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro-Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Greig.
Among my fondest hopes, and perhaps the most forlorn, is the possibility that at some point enough Americans are going to set aside these arbitrary labels that we've affixed to each other, or, more properly put, have had affixed to us by the people who presume to rule us, and start talking about individual liberty irrespective of the brand names that have been attached to various political views. We start talking about life, liberty, property, the need for the rule of law to protect life, liberty, and property, set aside the high school pep rally partisanship that really blinds us to the fact that we are constantly kept at daggers drawn with each other by people who have an interest in keeping us so mad at each other and so distracted by our programmed dislikes that we don't pay attention to what the people at the top of the political pyramid are doing. I remember having a conversation of this sort about, oh my gosh, 16 years ago in Cairo, Egypt, through a translator, because I don't speak Arabic, but I remember being interviewed by national television in Cairo and talking with whatever people happened to be watching that television program, talking to them, not with them, about the need for people, irrespective of nationality, to start thinking in terms of that sort. I'm not talking about doing away with nations as we know them. I'm not talking about creating some kind of a polyglot, one-world type of a culture, because such things really are not going to exist unless, of course, they're forced on us by the people at the top of the pyramid. But that was more or less the substance of what I was saying. Pay attention to what the people at the top of the political pyramid are doing. And, of course, in Egypt, the subject of the pyramids comes to the mind unbidden. One of the reasons why I'm starting off on this particular note this evening is a terrific essay that was published in yesterday's Salon.com by a writer I've referred to on many occasions on this program and for whom my respect grows pretty much every time I read him, and that's Glenn Greenwald. Mr. Greenwald's a few years younger than I am. He is a former practicing attorney in New York City who focused on issues of civil liberties and individual rights. Those are not necessarily the same things. Civil liberties could refer, of course, to what are conventionally called civil rights. Civil rights, as referred to in the Eighth Federalist Paper, have to do with the franchise, voting, all those things that involve one's political participation. Civil rights, civil liberties, are not necessarily the same thing. They are worthy. They are not the end, the be-all and end-all of our conversation where individual liberty is concerned. But Mr. Greenwald is somebody who's sort of loosely attached to the ACLU. His views on social issues are certainly not the same as mine. But when it comes to the question of the Constitution and the application thereof to issues having to do with state power directed at individuals, he and I are almost always in agreement. He starts off referring to the phenomena I just discussed here, which is the way that we're cattle-penned into arbitrary political categories and then assigned a constituency. That is to say, we're assigned to a constituency. And we're told that only those of us who are part of this conversation, part of the pre-programmed conversation involving these two brand names, are permitted to participate in the political conversation. His essay is entitled, "Who Are the Real Crazies in Our Political Culture?" One of the favorite self-affirming pastimes of establishment Democratic and Republican pundits is to mock anyone and everyone outside of the two-party mainstream as crazy, sick lunatics, writes Mr. Greenwald. That serves to bolster the two political parties as the sole arbiters of what is acceptable. Anyone who meaningfully deviates from those orthodoxies are, by definition, fringe, crazy losers. Ron Paul is one of the most frequently smeared in that fashion. And even someone like Howard Dean, during those times when he stepped outside of mainstream orthodoxy, was similarly smeared as literally insane and still is. Last night, the crazy, hateful, fringe lunatic Ron Paul voted to repeal the Clinton-era Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, or more accurately, he voted to allow the Pentagon to repeal it if and when it chooses to. While 26 normal, sane, upstanding, mainstream House Democrats voted to retain that bigoted policy. I insert myself here to point out that I don't necessarily share Mr. Greenwald's opinion of that policy, or for that matter, Ron Paul's opinion. The point that I'm underscoring here by reading Glenn Greenwald's column is that he has identified the mechanism I just referred to, where you have two entirely fungible brands of corporatist statism, Democrat and Republican, being, of course, the two brand names, and you have to be one or the other. Otherwise, you're not worthy to take part in the political conversation. And unfortunately, in the system we live in right now, politics is the measure of all things. If you're not involved in politics, you will be expropriated. You will be put into a position where everything that you hold precious is fair game for those who are part of this grand orgy of participatory plunder that is our mass democracy. I continue now from Glenn Greenwald's column. Paul explained today that he changed his mind on Don't Ask, Don't Tell because gay constituents of his who were forced out of the military convinced him of the policy's wrongness. How insane and evil he is. In 2003, the crank lunatic monster Ron Paul vehemently opposed the invasion of Iraq, while countless sane, normal, upstanding, good-hearted Democrats, including the current Vice President, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Senate Majority Leader, House Majority Leader, the 2004 Democratic presidential nominee, and many of the progressive pundits who loved to scorn Ron Paul as insane, supported the monstrous attack on that country. In 2008, the sicko Ron Paul opposed the legalization of Bush's warrantless eavesdropping program and the granting of retroactive immunity to law-breaking telecoms. While the Democratic Congress, led by the current U.S. President, his chief of staff, the Senate Majority Leader, the Speaker of the House, and the House Majority Leader, overwhelmingly voted it into law, Paul, who apparently belongs in a mental hospital, vehemently condemned America's use of torture from the start, while many leading Democrats were silent or even supportive. And mainstream, sane, progressive Newsweek and MSNBC pundit Jonathan Alter was explicitly calling for its use. Compare Paul's February 2010 emphatic condemnation of America's denial of habeas corpus, lawless detentions, and presidential assassinations of U.S. citizens to what the current U.S. government is doing. And, of course, the current U.S. government is headed by that holy, beatified personage, even the Blessed One, Barack Obama. To continue, the crazed monster Ron Paul also opposes the war in Afghanistan while the Democratic Congress continues to fund it and even to reject timetables for withdrawal. Paul is an outspoken opponent of the nation's insane, devastating, and oppressive drug war that imprisons hundreds of thousands of Americans with a vastly disparate racial impact and continuously incinerates both billions of dollars and an array of basic liberties, while virtually no Democrat dares speak against it. Paul crusades against limitless corporate control of government and extreme Federal Reserve secrecy, while the current administration works to preserve it. He was warning of the collapsing dollar and housing bubble at a time when our nation's bipartisan cast of geniuses were oblivious. In sum, behold the embodiment of clinical, certifiable insanity. Anti-Don't Ask, Don't Tell, anti-Iraq War, anti-illegal domestic surveillance, anti-drug war, anti-secrecy, anti-corporatism, anti-telecom immunity, anti-war in Afghanistan. Continues Mr. Greenwald, there's no question that Ron Paul holds some views that are wrong, irrational, and even odious. And I would be willing to bet, by the way, that I would disagree with Mr. Greenwald's assessment of those policies. But that's true for just about every single politician in both major political parties. Just look at the condition of the U.S. if you doubt that. And now, note how Ron Paul's anti-abortion views render him an untouchable for progressives, while Harry Reid's anti-abortion views permit him to be a progressive hero and even Senate Majority Leader. My point isn't that Ron Paul is not crazy. By the way, Ron Paul is not crazy in any sense of the word. It's that those who self-righteously apply that label to him and to others invariably embrace positions and support politicians at least as quote-unquote crazy. Indeed, those who support countless insane policies and or who support politicians in their own party who do, from the Iraq War to the drug war, from warrantless eavesdropping and denial of habeas corpus to presidential assassinations and endless war in the Muslim world, love to spit the crazy label at anyone who falls outside of the two-party establishment. This behavior, continues Greenwald, is partially driven by the adolescent high school version of authoritarianism. Anyone who deviates from the popular cliques, standard Democrats and Republicans, is a fringe loser who must be castigated by all those who wish to be perceived as normal, and is partially driven by the desire to preserve the power of the two political parties to monopolize all political debates and define the exclusive venues for sanity and mainstream acceptability. But regardless of what drives this behavior, it's irrational and nonsensical in the extreme. I've been writing for several years about this destructive dynamic, continues Greenwald, whereby people who embrace clearly crazy ideas and crazy politicians anoint themselves the arbiters of sanity simply because they're good mainstream Democrats and Republicans and because the objects of their scorn are not. We'll continue with this after the break. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio, a certifiable freedom-obsessed lunatic, I suppose, on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. And we'll continue with this after these messages, so don't go away.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
1-866-986-6397 is our call and number here on the Liberty News Radio Network. Before the break, I was talking, hopefully you were listening, to me read Glenn Greenwald's piece from Salon.com yesterday, Who Are the Real Crazies in Our Political Culture? And he was talking about the fact that Ron Paul, who's the best example of this transpartisan approach to liberty-centered politics, has been traduced for years, if not decades, as somebody who's certifiably insane by people who do not disagree with the general thrust of his policies, at least in terms of their professed values and political objectives. And yet they don't look at his record. They look at those elements of his record that don't happen to align with their prejudices. And because Mr. Paul and Glenn Greenwald, for the most part here, is excoriating Democrats, and you could have somebody from the opposite side of this narrow political divide do the same thing with the Republicans. He's excoriating Democrats who don't pay attention to the fact that Ron Paul is consistent and principled. And when it comes to matters in which the issues and constituencies that are important to the Democrats are on the receiving end of the ox-goring effect of government, Ron Paul is on their side. But because some of his positions on issues are not a comfortable fit for democratic liberalism, he's treated as if he's somebody who should be consigned to bedlam. And this, of course, is a reflection of this petty, puerile, juvenile, adolescent attachment to a political party as our team. What's important, of course, is that our team be victorious at whatever expense to the principles that we profess. And that is because, as Greenwald points out, as I have been saying for years, or if not merely years, longer, we have been indoctrinated and acculturated into the belief that there are two parties, that they were set in stone in terms of their definitions and their appeals to a certain constituency, that their place in the firmament of American politics is permanent, fixed, and eternal, and that it is something akin to the laws of the Medes and Persians in terms of the durability of the principle in question, that you must be one or the other, and if you are neither, you can't take part in politics. And the problem here, of course, is that these two parties are interchangeable in terms of the impact they have on life, liberty, and property. Who was it who first made this observation? I don't know, but a really good and authoritative expression of this by way of a cynical strategy for manipulating the public was laid out in Carol Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope. Many of you have probably heard of Tragedy and Hope. Some of you might have read some of it. I've read as much of it as I care to, which is several hundred pages in that tree-devouring monstrosity of a book. But toward the end of that book, Mr. Quigley makes the following observation and offers the following admonition by way of controlling electoral politics in the United States. This is from Tragedy and Hope. Quote, "The argument that the two parties should represent opposed ideals and policies, one perhaps of the right and the other of the left, is a foolish idea acceptable only to the doctrinaire and academic thinkers. Instead, the two parties should be almost identical, so that the American people can throw the rascals out at any election without leading to any profound or extreme shifts in policy." And Dr. Quigley went on to talk about the fact that either party in power after a certain period of time grows weak, corrupt, and listless. And when that happens, when one party becomes damaged goods politically, it can be replaced every 2 years or every 4 years if necessary by the other party, which will continue seamlessly carrying on the same policies that had been enshrined in practice by the previous party. And that's what we've got going on right now. We've got a dialectical tag team arrangement where the Republicans, the pachyderms, hold power for a while, then the jackasses take over. But there are no dramatic shifts or breaks in policy. I do believe that we've got a caller on the line who's been exemplary in his patience. Jeff from Chelsea, Massachusetts, I think, is with us. Jeff, are you there?
Oh, yes, I'm right here. Now, your points are absolutely brilliant. And let me make a contribution to those points, and that is, let's say in Massachusetts, I emphasize Massachusetts,
exactly.
I ran for public office, and I run as a Republican, and my platforms would be such, if I get elected as a federal representative, I will try to eliminate Roe v. Wade. That's the first thing I'm going to do as Republican candidate for the office of representative. Second, I would try to get homosexuals out of the military. If we find out you're homosexual in the military, a lesbian, you are out. If you are a radical Muslim, you are out. In other words, get the subversive element out, and states' rights. I mean, if my state of Massachusetts wants to have one thing and another state doesn't, that should be up to the state. And we should not be fighting these ridiculous wars. Only by an act of Congress that the president would be authorized to get us into a war. I would be a constitutionalist. You know what would happen if I tried doing all this stuff? I would be labeled an old school Republican. I wouldn't even make it the first base.
Yeah. You'd be treated with the same type of astringent disdain that was directed at Ron Paul in 2008 when he wasn't even allowed basically to participate in the Republican convention in Minneapolis, St. Paul, which is why they had a different convention for people who were attached to the Ron Paul Campaign for Liberty presidential candidacy and so forth. And that's the same type of thing that even happens in a state like Idaho, quite frankly. Think in Idaho, a couple of other places in the United States, there'd be Republican parties that'd be more congenial to the views you express. But there is this understanding that if you want to be part of the conversation, if you want a seat at the table, there's a certain price for admission, and that price involves sloughing off your professed convictions and making yourself acceptable to those who are the custodians of this bipartisan consensus that Carol Quigley talked about. And the positions that you just discussed, particularly the states' rights business, which coming from somebody in Massachusetts, of course, is a very unusual perspective to be hearing. The states' rights stuff in particular is going to get in trouble with those who believe that Washington should be the center of the universe and that all power should be sucked into the center and then be used to ordain how the states will function rather than the other way around. So what you're describing is by no means uncommon, unfortunately.
Exactly. I mean, even poor Alan Keyes, who's one of my heroes, got locked out of a debate. The poor guy got arrested, I think it was in Atlanta. I mean, come on, the guy's one of my heroes, and he's predicting martial law. I mean, the guy's brilliant. The man has a smooth, silk tongue. He would beat all of these jackasses and become president instead of Obama, but because the money's been put on Obama, he gets into office, and Alan Keyes is freezing in the cold. And you know what's funny is, ironically speaking, now I know I'm getting off subject, but it makes for good intellectual food. Alan Keyes ran for senator in Illinois. Guess who the people voted for? Obama. So it's not color, my friend. It is ideals and bacon. If I was a representative, I would say, look, I will not steal money out of your pocket for pork barrel programs, no big digs, no hack jobs. You are not getting one red cent of the taxpayers' money, no illegals whatsoever, closed door policy, and basically that's it. The welfare state would be taken down, low to moderate income houses would be dismantled, It would be Ozzy and Harry instead of Ozzy and Harry. No gay marriage. I would shred everything and get us back to a constitutionalist republic like we used to be. And you know what, before I go, I would be delegated as a complete lunatic.
Oh, sure. You'd be lucky that you don't end up somewhere doped out on Thorazine and living with rubber walls. Jeff, thanks so much for calling in. It's good to hear from you. Yeah. The reason why Obama is where he is because he was willing to take dictation from the people who fill his doggy dish and determine to the very last link, the precise length of his chain, the chain that's attached to his collar. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call number. We'll be back with more seditious sentiments after this. As if by way of deliberately and explicitly confirming what Glenn Greenwald says here about the way that people who step outside the artificial boundaries of political orthodoxy are denigrated as being insane, being psychologically infirm. And incidentally, doesn't that have sort of a Soviet flavor about it? Back in the abysmal era in which Leonid Brezhnev and that ossified gerontocracy was running the Soviet Union, say the 1970s, late 1960s, 1970s, it was a fairly common thing for people who were political dissidents who were involved in what was called samizdat. That's, I believe, a term of art that entered the Russian vocabulary in the 1960s. It refers to unauthorized publication of unsanctioned political views. What they would do is that often by hand, they would copy the writings of various dissidents, Solzhenitsyn being prominent among them, and distribute them through networks that were supposed to be outside the scrutiny, which was pretty all-encompassing of the KGB. But people who were found to be incorrigibly opposed to the Soviet ruling elite were diagnosed with some kind of a mental affliction and sent to the Soviet psychiatric gulag, the psyhuska. There were a number of people who were literally put on psychotropic drugs to the point where the brains were destroyed. There were at least a handful of cases that have been documented where lobotomies were performed. And this is because somebody who took that kind of position, who was a rejectionist when it came to the glories of Soviet socialism, obviously had to be psychologically infirm, because only a mind that is infirm, that isn't functioning properly, could fail to be seduced by the self-evident beauty of Soviet socialism. Well, we have the same type of assumptions embedded in our political system here with respect to the sanctified, exalted, bipartisan consensus. We're told that politics has to take place within, well, how does the cliche go? The 40-yard lines. Well, of course, if you think of it this way, if you use that metaphor, what that means is that neither side really wins. Because in order to score, you have to get beyond the 40-yard line. You either have to kick a field goal, or you have to move the ball downfield and put it in the end zone. And of course, if you believe that the purpose of politics is to do something that would be a victory from the perspective of advancing the cause of human freedom, the last thing that the people who were the custodians of the bipartisan consensus would countenance would be movement toward the end zone. The 40-yard lines, of course, are defined by people who are statists, people who believe that we have a system that serves the interests of the political elite and that we exist basically to provide them with position. Anybody remember that line from Braveheart? You think the people exist to provide you with position? I think your position exists to provide them with freedom. I believe we have another caller, Sam from Owensville. Are you with us this evening, Sam?
I am here, Bill, and I want to really thank you for your show. I'll tell you, Saturday nights were an absolute drag around here until you turned up, so thank you.
You're very kind. Thank you so much.
Oh, you bet. I remember you were on during the weekdays, but it was always at a time I could never really catch you. Well, now you're on the weekends. It's just a whole lot more convenient. And
I think it's an improvement for everybody.
It is, and you're no stranger to me. I've read a lot of your articles up online through places like Covenant News and various other places. And
oh, good.
So word is getting around. In view of what you're talking about, you know, with the which my wife Trish and I we get after this business of this right left paradigm that as opposed to right versus wrong. You know, it's kind of like it's used to cloud the real issue. And the one thing I wanted to mention that you know, it's so interesting how we seem to be in such naivete in this country. Urge everybody online, if you can, because I was literally blown away by this article. If you can do some research online, you should be able to find it in the search engine. It's called Don't Let Freedom Slip Away, and it was written by a woman from Austria by the name of Kitty Wertmann.
Oh, yeah. Yes. And
I don't know if you've had a chance to read that or not, Bill, but I heard her interviewed here on another show here a while back that we run here on the small station here where we live, and she... Literally, I mean, the woman just blew me away with some of the stuff she's been involved in here in the States trying to preserve liberty and freedom. And I don't know if you ever do interviews, but if you can track her down and do an interview with her, I'm sure your audience would really
I think that's a wonderful idea.
Yeah. She's in South Dakota. That's all I can tell you. I haven't been able to get any closer than that.
Now, is she the same one who did a presentation that was distributed as a CD and an audio cassette by Ed Griffin's Freedom Force? I think that might be the same person.
She might be, but if it was, I'm not aware of it. That doesn't mean anything because, you know, with G. Edward Griffin, he gets around. He gets around
yes,
to just about everybody. And,
yeah.
And, of course...
He's indefatigable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I read all of his stuff, too, but... it's possible that he might have done that before I came on board and started catching up with a lot of his material. But
okay.
But one of the interesting
could you
things
summarize
she,
very quickly?
Go ahead.
Forgive
I'm
me,
sorry.
Sam. Could you summarize just for the benefit of our listeners who've not been exposed to her writings or her speeches, what she says in terms of the ominous parallels that she sees, and the most important developments that she's decrying?
Well, what she said is, first of all, that contrary to popular belief, Hitler was elected into Austria by 98% of the vote, which is contrary to what most of us have been led to believe here. But there was so many things. Gun control, they registered the guns first, which what have we done here?
Sure.
And then, of course, things went a little bit faster than they did here. We're doing it more of the Fabian style, but... But first they register the guns, then after they register the guns, then they say, well, that's not working. We're still having hunting accidents and people shooting people, so we have to confiscate the guns. And they did that there. She said eventually it was forbidden to listen to any other programs other than what the federal government wanted you to listen to. In other words, everybody was issued free radios, and you were to tune to only what they wanted you to listen to and nothing else.
Call that net neutrality.
Yeah.
In the 1930s milieu.
Yeah, absolutely. And then she said that in businesses, just like we have today regulating the daylights out of everybody, she said businesses back then, like restaurants, Hitler required round tables as opposed to square tables because people might bump themselves. And yeah, that was one of them.
It's just interesting to think of Adolf Hitler being so solicitous toward the possibility that somebody would get hurt.
Yeah, yeah.
But, of course, this was just the way he was. He was so overflowingly benevolent toward people. And in the course of expressing this paternalistic benevolence, he acquired total power over people. Then he started to dispose of those who were troublesome.
Absolutely.
It's really
and
interesting,
she talks
the psychology.
About that in the article, too. And if people read the 1968 Gun Control Act, it comes right out of his playbook.
Yep, transliterated right from the German.
Yep, absolutely. So people need to do some research for that one, too. But in the interesting interview that I heard with her here a while back on another broadcast, she made the statement because the host of the particular show asked her, how long did she think we had left before the other shoe would drop? And she said, well, she said, it's right around the corner. She made the statement, she said, already Arizona has passed a law against the illegals, and she said, look for other states to do it, and then the riots will begin.
Yeah.
And
what's going to happen here, just let me interject myself
here,
what's going to happen is that in the interest of the 14th Amendment, making sure that these are equally applied, everybody's going to have identity papers, and that's already enshrined in the Democrat proposal for a national immigration reform law that would include a national biometric ID card everybody would have to have as the sole signifier of who you are for the purposes of getting a job. That's where we're headed here in terms of the grand dialectical do-say-do. You'll get these laws passed, or this version, some version of these laws passed in all these states. There'll be pressure from below in terms of the riots. And by way of a grand compromise, they'll say, look, we have to do something about this. Let's make it fair. Everybody has to have papers that they will display at the demand of an armed state functionary. That's the direction we're headed, and I can see this happening in the next year and a half or so.
Yeah, and the interesting thing, too, that she had stated was that in 1985, she infiltrated some of the communist groups, you know, with people like Barbara Boxer and some of those people back in 1985, and she made the statement that they had said to her back in 1985 that the illegals would invade the country somewhere between 2004 and 2010, somewhere, she said, depending upon who the president was going to be at that time, and that the churches would be used to bring the illegals in. They knew that as far back as 1985 that this would all happen.
That doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me you'd find people of that persuasion clustering around the likes of Barbara Boxer either, quite frankly.
Yeah, and I guess the thing that I want to state out of this whole thing, Bill, this is why I always tell people, you know, instead of kicking our elderly people to the curb, whether they're Austrian or American or whomever, those are the ones that, you know, they've been around like during the Depression and times like that. Those are the people we really need to be paying attention to.
I agree wholeheartedly. Sam, thanks so much for calling. It's great to hear from you.
You bet.
My best to your family. God bless you.
You too.
Hope to hear from you again.
Mm-hmm.
This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. Hey, James, if you're still out there, we'll go to you right after the break. And we'll be back in just a couple of minutes, so stick around.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
James from Hodges, South Carolina, I believe it's South Carolina, has been waiting patiently. James, how are you doing this evening?
I'm doing well.
Good.
I have two things, a specific one and then a general one. About, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was talking to you about immigration. And the question I ask you is, what do you do about disease? And you said you would think about it.
Yeah.
Well, you've had time to think about it.
As part of the naturalization process, you have to be able to find out if people are bringing communicable diseases into the country. So that's obviously something that, as far as naturalization is concerned, would be part of the process. One of the big problems that we have had historically, and as a matter of fact, before we were a country, before we were the United States, the people who were living here prior to the European arrival had this problem with the Europeans who showed up and bringing smallpox and other communicable diseases for which the people living here, I don't like to use the expression Native Americans to refer specifically to them, a Native American is anybody who's born in America.
Russell Means says you can call people Indians. I heard him say
that. Yeah, as a matter of fact, he's adamant on the subject.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to be called a Native American. He wants to be called an American Indian. And so I think that's a better way of approaching it. But, yeah, if you're dealing here with something for which you have a legitimate health concern, that's obviously something that's going to have to be part of the process. You're going to have to be able to find out if somebody's going to bring in an aggressive communicable disease that's going to lay waste to people. And that's one of the things that's simply a reality of the circumstances we live in. How we go about applying that in matters of detail is a complicated subject about which I'm going to have to become more intelligent. I'm going to have to be doing more study. But in terms of the principle, the thing that strikes me as an obvious and sensible public policy position.
Well, I have read, I think this is correct, that people were brought in with Hansen's disease. There were 9 cases of Hansen's disease in Arkansas.
I'm not familiar with that.
Do I?
What is that?
Leprosy.
Leprosy. How long ago was this?
It was within the past couple of years. Now, I don't think it's that communicable, but it's my understanding that the people were brought in from the Marshall Islands where leprosy is, you know, one of the few places in the world where leprosy is still a problem, and they were brought in. Now, how communicable?
Yeah.
I don't think it's as communicable as people once thought it was. But anyway,
no,
I think it did happen. If it didn't happen, I'll just be wrong.
Yeah, but I'll have to look into that. But yeah, that would be disturbing. And You're right. That's one of those diseases that unfortunately has a certain marquee appeal because of what we read in the New Testament.
Yes.
And it's not as aggressively communicable as some people think that it is, but it's still a pretty awful disease. And it's one of those diseases that we thought we were finished with, but unfortunately it clings tenaciously to some remote corners of the planet, well, some remote corners of the world, I should say. There are no corners on a globe. The other thing that I was just thinking, of course, is that given the almost universal eradication of smallpox, that's something that could be really troublesome. If we suddenly ended up with a population that had smallpox, we could recreate, in a lesser sense, some of the dynamics of what happened to the American Indians when the Europeans showed up.
Yeah.
Of course, we had some friendly efforts by some of the British to propagate that plague by way of deliberate and cynical policy, but I don't think we'd be dealing with that same type of that same type of ideology today, because I think that we'd be able to address it from a public health perspective a lot more quickly than obviously the Stone Age American Indian cultures could deal with it. But that's one of those I wake up screaming type scenarios, that suddenly we end up with a revenant of a plague we thought was long dead, tearing to pieces the American population. That's one of those things that disturbs my sleep from time to time. And I think that's because I've got six kids and one of them is sick all the time. My mind dwells on such unpleasant topics.
Well, I have something else that's much more general.
Right.
I've heard you categorize yourself as, if you categorize yourself as anything, as a Christian libertarian. I believe you use that phrase.
Yeah. That's as suitable a description as any I can think of.
Well, libertarianism frightens people the first time they hear about it.
Yeah.
My experience is when I talk to people, people will look at you strange and walk away.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you deal with it? And how will you deal with it on a national level? I mean, I personally
believe
it's the most rational thing going.
Yeah.
And I think when people understand it, most people seem to agree. But it's not something that people warm up to overnight. It takes a while.
That's true. But what's really interesting is that if you're having a conversation among people who are politically aware, at some point or another, one of them is likely to say, well, I really am a libertarian at heart. In other words, there's something about the idea of a freedom-fixated political philosophy that resonates with most people, probably because of the high school civics class concepts that they've absorbed regarding the Declaration of Independence and so forth. Generally speaking, if I'm having a conversation about politics with people, we'll talk about specific cases, and we'll go from the specific to the general. We'll be talking about disagreements that we have or points of agreement that we have. And then after we have already laid out some elements of our respective political philosophy, somebody will say, well, how do you describe yourself if you have a political orientation, or if there's a certain label that you'd cling to, how would you describe yourself? And I'll say, well, my perspective is that of Christian libertarianism or Christian individualism. I more often heard to describe myself as a Christian individualist than Christian libertarian, because unfortunately there's a large party called the Libertarian Party that more or less has branded that label or taken possession of that label. And for the most part, the people who have run as libertarian candidates have not been people I've been willing to support, Ron Paul being the notable exception. Badnarik was a pretty good guy too, I think. But in most conversations of that sort, I don't start out by labeling myself. We usually end up, when I'm having a political conversation with somebody who doesn't know me, hasn't listened to the show or read what I have to say in print, people for the most part will ask that question after we've already explored a couple of specific cases, and usually there's a great deal of agreement, or if there's disagreement, it's this disagreement of a sufficiently amicable nature that by the time we get to labels, they're usually more interested in what I have to say than any label that they would use by way of prejudicing their opinion about me. And so I do think that if you have the argument on the basis of principle before the label is introduced, that's the better way to conduct the conversation, if that's at all possible. It's not always possible, but I'm finding that more and more frequently people are warming up to small L libertarianism, when we're seeing the contrary policies being pursued with such avidity in Washington and wreaking such havoc on our economy. It seems to me that libertarianism is really gaining ground, if only on the strength of the negative example of Washington.
Well, it seems so to me, but the immigration situation and other things, the status quo militates against accepting libertarianism. And to be a libertarian, to have a libertarian country, one could not do it overnight, it seems to me. Or do you disagree?
No, it can't be done overnight.
Do what?
Yeah, just starting from where we are right now, it can't be done overnight. But there are ways that it can be done a lot more quickly than most people would assume. If we end up having to reboot the entire economy, you know what I think, we'll find that it can literally be done in a matter of weeks or months because there would be no other alternative. You know,
well,
people are going to have to be localist and agorist in their outlook. You know, would be reduced basically to barter, and in that situation, basically, you're going to have life, liberty, and property, uber alla, and all this other administrative stuff's going to fall away. If we end up with a tidal wave of municipal bankruptcies in this country, I think you're going to have libertarian alternatives being explored city by city. I wouldn't say that that's a very likely scenario. It's a very possible scenario. Every week brings new and ominous, but potentially optimistic tidings of another large municipality considering bankruptcy. There's a whole bunch of municipalities in California that are on the bubble right now. And so there are possibilities here in terms of building from the ground up on the rubble of these little socialist enclaves, libertarian-oriented or at least more libertarian societies. In England right now, Mr. Clegg, who is, I guess, the de facto vice president of England, is talking about rolling back the Blair-era police state measures. He's actually polling people. He's taking suggestions from people about what laws to repeal. That's in England, for heaven's sake. Good old socialist Blighty. So, you know, there are possibilities. I wouldn't say there are likelihoods, but there are possibilities. So I'll take my optimism where I can find it.
Okay. Thank you, Will.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
Okay.
And you're blessed to live in South Carolina, one of my favorite places on earth. Yeah. South Carolina, of course, is a rebellious state. That's why I find it so enchanting. The cradle of the old Confederacy, and boy, do they pay for it in Reconstruction. Speaking of which, if you go to lewrockwell.com right now, the second item on today's lewrockwell.com is an essay republished from my blog, Pro Libertate, entitled Civil Rights in Shock Quotes, Civil Rights and Total War. I'd recommend that you read that if you have time. It's a rather lengthy essay, and it's a perfectly infuriating one. But if you read that, and I think I'll discuss it a little bit after the break at the beginning of next hour, you'll get a better perspective of what we're talking about in terms of the way that the people running the media and running the two-party system want to prevent us from having conversations about first principles. Civil rights is a wonderful example. I think I'll take that up at the beginning of next hour. First hour is over. Join us again in just a couple of minutes for hour two of Pro Libertate, the weekend edition. 866-986-6397 is our call number. We'll be back in a couple of minutes, and I hope to hear from you.